Hey, Martin Sharp, the Fit for Business, Fit for Life coach here, and I hope you're going to enjoy this next amazing episode of Road to Rediscovery by the amazing Aubrey Johnson. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Our lives are laid out on a road of bumps, turns, struggles, and more. How do we respond? How do we endure adversity for learning and growth? I'm Aubrey Johnson, and we'll explore these questions and more on the Road to Rediscovery. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Road to Rediscovery. I'm your host, Aubrey Johnson. The Road to Rediscovery is about reflecting on life lessons to learn and grow from them, and of course, pay it forward and uplift others who are struggling through dark times. Now, as you know, you can get this show anywhere you listen to your podcasts. If you happen to listen on Apple Podcasts, we invite you to leave a rate and review. Otherwise, anywhere else you listen to, no matter what platform around the world, we still want to hear your feedback. Just shoot us an email at roadtorediscoverypodcast@gmail.com. That's roadtorediscoverypodcast@gmail.com. And give us your thoughts, give us your input, and we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. Also, don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, Road to Rediscovery, on YouTube so that you can get notifications on every episode that drops and releases every single Thursday. We are always truly, truly grateful for your listenership. All right, my special guest is a retired Major General and a 36-year Army combat veteran with an absolute immense, extraordinary, and remarkable career. Among many other accolades and credentials, he's a qualified airborne ranger, engineer, soldier, and army strategist. He's also an accomplished author and a survivor of bipolar disorder. His book, Bipolar General, My Forever War with Mental Illness, is a candid introspective that chronicles his struggles and triumphs. Ladies and gentlemen, let's please welcome and get ready for some amazing insight on resilience, resolve, and living. Once again, let's welcome Major General Greg F. Martin. Greg, it's so great to have you here. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Aubrey. It's really just an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Oh, likewise. We are so delighted to have you here as well. And sir, if you can just give us a little context, okay, early on, if you can explain your early encounter with bipolar disorder. I mean, everyone has their own experience when it comes to things like these, but was this something that you knew at the time what it was, or did you not know what it was? What was your early experience with this?
So I had no idea that I was born with what I call a bipolar brain, that okay. I had the genetic predisposition for bipolar disorder. No idea. And I actually grew up on the bipolar spectrum, which means I had a condition called hyperthymia, which is a near continuous low-level mania that gave me extra energy, drive, enthusiasm, creativity, problem-solving skills. Mm-hmm. And in other words, being on the bipolar spectrum contributed to my success as a student, athlete, and leader for years and years. Mm-hmm. But what was happening at the same time, which again was totally unknown to me, was that I was slowly inching my way up the spectrum towards an onset of real bipolar disorder, which hit me in 2003 at age 47. Wow. And then again, it boosted my performance. It was totally unknown, undiagnosed. And it continued for about a dozen years where I started going into higher levels of mania, lower levels of depression, until I went into what they call full-blown mania, where I essentially went into a state of madness or insanity. And at that point, I was fired from my job, forced to retire, and hospitalized. And then I crashed into about 2 years of really deep, crippling depression plus terrifying psychosis. And that was about 8 years ago, I got on the right medications. And since then, I've been on a steady journey of recovery.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That's crystal clear context. Thank you so much for sharing that. And our subsequent topics and discussions are basically building blocks around that that you just established. So thank you so much for that, Greg. Want to talk about the lows in your disorder. Okay. Was there a recurring theme whenever you would have, say, a low episode or a low event? Was there a recurring theme regarding, I don't know, maybe voices that you may hear in your head regarding inadequacy or just anger or being enough or things that would question your self-esteem? I mean, was there any recurring theme during each of those lows, or was it just something different each time?
Well, some of the common elements are when you go into depression or you go into mania, what's actually happening with the bipolar brain is it's a disease of the brain. It's an illness, a disorder, and which means that the brain independently on its own volition, regardless of what you want, it starts to go into mania. It starts overproducing key chemicals like dopamine, endorphins, and others that then drives you up into mania. And then when the brain, this bipolar brain, decides, okay, I've had enough mania, I now am going to go into depression, regardless of what you want, it starts to underproduce these same chemicals, thus driving you into depression. Some of the common elements with me, in my first significant depression was when I was about 18 years old. I was a freshman in college. And they continued for, you know, I was mostly manic, but I did have periods of depression. And the one thing is you get kind of a sick feeling in the bottom of your gut that just something's not right. I feel really bad. I feel down, depressed. And then you start to lose energy. You start becoming hopeless. You become withdrawn. For me, I would go from being an extrovert to an introvert. I would want to be by myself. I was confused, indecisive, and just lost interest in just everything that used to give me interest and pleasure. I would lose interest in it all. And so those are kind of the characteristics of it. But over time, as I got older and I started going into depression, all those symptoms got stronger, more pronounced, deeper, to where when I was in my 40s and 50s, I mean, it was really a chore just to get out of bed, just to decide what I'm going to wear, what kind of food I'm going to eat. It became my mind, my brain literally became crippled, so that instead of being, you know, really smart, you know, PhD from MIT, I was terrible. I could hardly put a sentence together, which means my brain was essentially shutting down.
I see. Now, I don't know, metaphorically speaking, I guess, when you reach that full manic state, is that a pinnacle, or is that the lowest point in a disorder such as this?
I would say it's a pinnacle because, you know, you're basically, mania is going up where your mind is super sharp. Your creativity is really high. Your energy is really high. You don't need much sleep. You're interested in everything. Mm-hmm. You think you're the smartest person in the world. Mm-hmm. I felt I was Superman. And so I would say the mania is it's the high point, the pinnacle. It's the, you know, the upside of this disease. But the problem with mania is that once it goes too high, it becomes very, very dangerous. It becomes dangerous because you start lacking self-control. You can go totally off the rails, over the top, lose control, you know, get in fights, violent encounters, attack other people, get arrested, get, you know, killed by the police, get put in jail, die by suicide. And the other thing is that when you go into mania, your whole system is pumping harder and harder. So all your organs are in overdrive. And so it increases the risk of a heart attack and a stroke as well.
I see. So like a tachometer, I mean, you're pretty much redlining at that
yes.
point. And medication. Yeah, that's a great, I see.
That's a great analogy.
Thank you. Yeah. And again, trying to understand medication helps regulate that and balance that. So there's not so many red lines and maybe not so many lows of lows and not so many extreme highs of highs. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. Fantastic. So, I want to ask you about stigma, Greg. I believe, and I think it's common. I mean, a lot of people talk about this. There's already a stigma in general society. You know, when it comes to someone who is bipolar, I'm saying clinically diagnosed bipolar, because unfortunately there's some cases in society where people are so quick to judge and people are so quick to draw conclusions and assumptions without knowing full stories of other people and their struggles, their journeys, right? So, but when someone knows that someone is clinically diagnosed as bipolar, there's still some stigmas that unfortunately comes with that, okay? My question to you, Greg, is were there any added stigmas, okay, when it came to someone diagnosed with bipolar who is highly ranked, decorated, soldiers such as yourself?
Yes. I think the fact that I was a very high-ranking officer with, you know, tremendous success in my career, mm-hmm. once I started losing it and went into full-blown mania and was fired and all of that, I think there was an increased stigma sort of pointed at me because I had been so successful and because I was a general, that probably a lower ranking person, you know, a private or a sergeant or a young officer, they wouldn't have felt such a stigma. Right. But for me, because I was successful, that then when I essentially, you know, failed because of my disorder, I think it really heightened the stigma and made it stronger.
Understood. Understood. Yeah. And I can see that given your tenure, in the military, there could be a stronger, more added stigma to that. So what was your recipe for recovery? What are some of the elements that, allowed you to, make that, that pivot, that turn? I know it wasn't instant. I know it wasn't overnight and it's a process, but what are some of the elements that played a significant role in your recovery?
Yeah, that's a great question. If it's okay, I'm just going to touch a little more on stigma.
Yes, please.
Stigma is it's really the most significant issue that keeps people from getting the help they need if they're, you know, having a mental health issue.
Yeah.
Stigma is prejudice. It's based on fear, on ignorance, and there's really no place for it. Because when you think about it, if a person has cancer or heart disease or diabetes, there's no stigma at all because everybody recognizes that it's a biological, physiological malady. Well, sure. Mental illness is also biological, physiological, but it takes place in the brain. So yeah. Really, it's completely uncalled for. It's unjust. It's ignorant. It ignores science, and there's no place for it. If you go back 50 years, just as an example, breast cancer in women was stigmatized, and women were ashamed, embarrassed. Nobody talked about it until the first lady, Betty Ford, in the 70s, got breast cancer, and she talked openly about it, put it out in the open.
Yeah.
And think about the way our society has changed over 50 years. It really launched a social movement to where yes. now women yes. fighting breast cancer are seen as heroic figures. You know,
right.
the NFL players wear pink shoes, pink ribbons, pink socks.
They sure
and
do.
I think that people battling mental illness, we need the same kind of a social movement to get rid of the stigma, to stop stigma altogether. So those are just a couple of things I want to say about stigma. Your main question was, you know, what was my road to recovery? Well, my onset was in 2003, age 47, but I wasn't finally diagnosed until 2014 when I was 58.
Yeah.
And the first step is you have to get a diagnosis. And the thing about a diagnosis for me was, okay, I knew there was something wrong because I was in terrible depression, but I didn't know what was wrong. But once I got the diagnosis, I said, okay, I have a target with a face on it. I'm going to embrace this. I can go to war with this condition and beat it. And so step one was diagnosis. Unfortunately, that was a great thing. I hugged the doctor and thanked him, but I went from bad to worse. And so the next 2 years were horrible. I was in bipolar hell, which was just awful. I had passive suicidal ideations. I wanted to die. My life was just a wreck. But finally, after hospitalization and getting on the right medication, I started the road to recovery. And I would say the road to recovery consists of the following elements. Number one, you have to get on the right medication.
Right.
And that can take some time. Like for me, it took about 2 years before I finally got the right combination of medicines. But once I did, it balanced my brain chemistry. And my symptoms of bipolar disorder, they went away within a week.
Wow.
It was unbelievable.
Wow.
And the second thing is you have to do therapy where you work with a trained psychotherapist and you work your way through these problems in your mind, how to deal with them, how to deal with agitation, anger, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
The third thing is just really healthful living that any person really needs to do. So healthy diet, plenty of exercise, plenty of sleep, drink lots of water, low stress, do mindfulness exercises, meditation, yoga, things that are going to keep you healthy. So those are the first three, and those are necessary, but they're not sufficient to have a recovery that's built to last.
Right.
To build it to last, you have to anchor those three things into what I call the five P's. And the first P is purpose. So you have to develop a purpose or a mission for yourself that gives you drive and motivation and makes you feel worthwhile as a person. And so for me, my purpose I developed was sharing my bipolar story to help stop the stigma, promote recovery, and save lives. The second P is people. It's critical to develop a network of happy, energetic, fun people that lift your spirits up. And so I had to work hard on that because I moved from New Hampshire to Florida, didn't know anybody. Third P is place. Really important to live in a place that's healthy and that gives you the ability to do the things you want. So we specifically moved from New Hampshire, which is, you know, beautiful for about 3 or 4 months a year. And then it's, you know, cold, dark, icy winter, gray.
Yeah.
And we moved to Florida, sunshine, warmth, brightness, palm trees. I mean, it's really nice and it helps my brain to be healthy. It helps me to be healthy in the brain.
Yes.
The fourth P is perseverance. You have to make up your mind that you want to get better and you're going to do whatever it takes to get healthy and to recover.
Right.
Because recovery from a mental illness is very difficult. It's very complicated. You'll have setbacks along the way. You might have relapses, but you have to have that perseverance, the will to win, the fighting spirit.
That's right.
And then the fifth P is what I call perspective. And what I mean by that is having the ability to get outside of one's own mind, to think objectively about one's own thinking. It's called metacognition is the fancy word. But the reason it's important is oftentimes our biggest problem is our own thinking. We think negative thoughts. We're paranoid. We think in ways that cause harm to us. So that's why perspective is so important. So anyway, that's my strategy, my roadmap for recovery.
I love it. I love it. And I love the five P's. I mean, and neither one of them are mutually exclusive, right? I mean, they all are intermingled with each other to where the sum of what they make is that recipe for true recovery.
Yes, wow. That's very well said.
Wow, that's amazing, Greg. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I wanted to ask you about this. And I was thinking about when it comes to elements and things that can help us when it comes to transformation, right? I find that it's interesting in life at times how the very element or the very virtue that, say, got you to where you are, you know, prior to transformation, there may be a piece or sliver of that that can attribute to the actual transforming. And here's what I mean. And I just want to ask this question because I'm truly and genuinely interested in this. And by the way, it kind of goes along with stigma, which you clearly shared some great insight for the listeners' benefit on stigma. There's no place for it. It's prejudice and that sort of thing. So I want to genuinely ask you this question, Greg. Knowing the elements like the five P's that you mentioned, okay, and as well as, you know, just having support, family, you know, strength and those sorts of things, you know, also faith, having faith, plays, all those things play a huge part in overcoming such a disorder as this. But in your experience personally, would it be fair to say that maybe some years or in all your extensive years in the military, training, developing the mental toughness that was required for just extenuating circumstances that you would face in the military, would that having and developing that mental toughness all those prior years, could that be an element that attributed or to some degree to your recovery?
Absolutely, yes. That's a Aubrey, that's a great point. I mean, years, you know, West Point, Army Ranger School, tough training, demanding stuff, you know, being food deprived, sleep deprived, you know, being in combat, being in jobs where you had tremendous pressure to make life and death decisions, yes, while you're being shot at. All of that stuff, I think, contributes to perseverance, willpower, the fighting spirit. And those are all things, like I talked about in the five F's, that are really necessary in order to have a recovery that is sustained and built to last. So the short answer is yes, absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. That's wonderful. And thank you for sharing that, because we talked about, and you shared clearly, crystal clearly, how during some various manic episodes, okay, while they were manic, before you were diagnosed, before you knew what it actually was, they actually attributed to your success in what your role required, right? So while it attributed to your success, and it was also attributing to the condition that you had, when it came to the role it plays in your recovery, the mental toughness that was developed from those experiences seemed to play a significant role in your transformation and recovery as well. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to provide that context for the listeners and how that played a role. I truly appreciate that. One other thing I wanted to touch on is, and I think you mentioned this, in general society over the past 50 years, right? How mental health has been perceived by society, you know, just and even breast cancer and how it was perceived. And then you talked about, you know, Betty Ford being the champion behind when it comes to drugs, medication, breast cancer, and then how we celebrate breast cancer as far as, you know, fighting for the awareness, and those who have it are heroes and we support and stand behind them. And I too, just as you, Greg, truly believe there needs to be some sort of social revolution for people to take a collective stand to give that same sort of support and appreciation and admiration, almost at a heroic level, for those who are battling this type of bipolar disorder, you know. I suppose it's going to take some years. It's going to take some evolution. But we've seen in society, general civilian society, the evolution of how mental health is recognized and acknowledged and received. Okay. My question to you, Greg, is given the traditional demands of the military when it comes to toughness, strategic thinking, resolve, steadiness, you know, and more, has there been an increase of acknowledging mental health in the military space throughout the years? What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, definitely. If you go back 20 years ago, prior to the 9/11 wars, mm-hmm. we have improved light years during this 20-year period. We have much more training and education about mental health and mental illness. Mm-hmm. We have a lot more resources that are being pushed into it in terms of, you know, social workers, therapists, psychiatrists that have been hired. It's very much the policy of the military is, you know, it's not weakness, but strength if you right. go get help. It's okay to not be okay. We have a battle buddy system, which in the civilian world is called a peer support system, where, you know, people have like a partner that keeps an eye on them till illnesses. So if they start seeing something going wrong, they can talk to their battle buddy and encourage them to go in and seek help. So those are all really good things. It used to be back pre 9/11 that service members were pretty much discharged for almost any kind of mental health condition. They were discharged medically. That's no longer the case. Right. So the military really bends over backwards to accommodate people. So, for example, today there's thousands of service members that are serving, you know, honorably with depression and yeah. are taking medicine and getting medical help for that. PTSD, yes. Survivor's guilt, moral injury, yes. anxiety disorder, substance abuse disorders, eating disorders. When it comes to bipolar disorder type 1, which is what I had, which is mostly mania and some depression, mm-hmm. Then chances are the service member will be discharged because the manic state is so dangerous for someone mm-hmm. in the military, you know, being around weapons and classified material.
Sure.
And the other mental illness that pretty much is they're discharged for is with schizophrenia, which is, you know, very, very severe mental illness. So all of those are really good, positive steps forward for the military. And the policies are very good. But there's a gap between these good policies and down where the rubber meets the road, where the, yeah. you know, boots on the ground. Because
boots on the ground.
The younger, lower ranking service members, they hear all this, but a lot of times they don't believe it. They yeah. still hear that it's stigmatized, which there still is a stigma. It's yeah. still incompatible with the culture of toughness and being strong and right. never showing weakness. Right. And so a lot of these younger service members, they hear all the positive stuff, but then they say, yeah, but I'm not going to go get help because I know it'll hurt me. I know there's a stigma. I don't want to put myself at risk. And so they don't go get the help that's available and that they could get. And so it's going to take some time to change the culture of the military to where the lower ranks accept it, believe it, and go get help.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, over time, it's got to get to that level, right? I mean, that's... especially at that level, being the more hands-on in the day-in, day-out nature of the work, right, and what they do, especially if it's combat. And man, as you were mentioning that, Greg, I was thinking, you have service members coming back from years ago, World War II or Vietnam or, you know, Korean War, and you know, just things like this weren't talked about. They'd have night terrors and all sorts of things, and expect it to, you know, continue to provide and you know, guidance and food and shelter and clothing for their families. And I mean, that's a lot to ask for, you know, for someone who's been through what they've been through. And whether it's during wartime or not, just the simple fact of, to your point, what the military requires and having that sort of disassociation between, you know, the vulnerability or the perceived vulnerability of someone being diagnosed with this and the required strength, mental and physical toughness that the military requires. So it sounds like in time and over time, it's going to take some more efforts and everything to get to that boots on the ground level. Yeah, this brings me to something I wanted to ask you regarding, you know, different approaches and how one, the most ideal way to approach addressing mental health, say there's a loved one who is who has a mental health condition, right? Can you share, for the benefit of the listeners, and break down what you would call a collaborative approach to mental health?
Sure. I would say that if you detect the signs of some kind of mental disorder or mental health condition in a family member, a friend, or a work colleague, the first thing to do is just be a compassionate person. Mm-hmm. Listen to them. You know, don't start giving directions and telling them what to do. Just listen. And when you give them a chance to speak and, you know, relate, you know, how they're feeling, what's going on in their life, if they're having problems, et cetera, then I think in a compassionate, encouraging way, mm-hmm. say, hey, you know, how about we go see, you know, a medical professional? How about if we go see a doctor or a therapist or a social worker? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I, you know, there's no harm in doing this, because if there's nothing wrong, then that's good to know.
Yeah.
But if there is something, you know, that needs treatment or attention, the good news is that it can be addressed, it can be taken care of, and you can live a happy, healthy life. But on the other hand, if you do have some sort of a mental issue and you don't get it taken care of, it's going to get worse, and it can lead to destruction of your marriage, your family, your career, loss of finance, addiction, homelessness, prison, and death. So you know, you kind of lay it out to them that, you know, without trying to scare them,
right,
but there are two real paths. One is you go get help and you can be fine. The other one is you don't and you could be destroyed. And then I would say the second thing is I would volunteer to go with them. I would say, hey, look, you know, I'm encouraging you to go see the doctor just so you don't feel alone. I'd be happy to go with you to the appointment. And what that does is it gives the person some reassurance that they can count on you, that you're a friend. And it also gives what the doctors call collateral information.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing for a patient to go in and sit down one-on-one with a doctor. And, you know, that's worthwhile. But think how much more information the doctor can get if there's a friend or a family member or a spouse. They can get
tremendous.
So much more information.
Yes.
And, you know, just like in my case, I had been evaluated 6 times over a period of years. And the doctor said, you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. And finally, on the 7th try, they got it right. And the key difference was that my wife provided information where she said, hey, Greg is very depressed right now. But before this, he was manic. And then the doctor said, aha, depression. Mania, manic depression, bipolar disorder. And so it was because of that information my wife provided that they were able to get the right diagnosis. So those are some of the things that I would say to try to get the person moving in the right direction. And then if they do get a diagnosis, then go back to what I talked about, my strategy. A friend or a family member can really, you know, help be an encourager, a guide, a partner to help somebody get on the right path and stay on it.
But yeah, it's important to be fully transparent, right, with the individual, letting them know not just the benefits that, you know, going to a medical professional would have, but also the ramifications and the consequences if they choose not to.
Right.
Which is, hugely, hugely important for sure. You kind of alluded to this in your explanation that you gave with this last question, Greg, but wanted to know if you had any more to add to this, okay? How does someone struggling through this disorder, and you've given many examples of how you can help them, okay? So, you know, most of this I'm sure you already answered, but if you want to add any more to this, please feel free. How does someone struggling through this disorder learn to live, you know, to live their life without letting this define them, define who they are?
Well, the first thing you have to do is when you get a diagnosis, accept it, embrace it, make a decision that you're going to own it, that you're not going to be stigmatized, you're not going to be ashamed or embarrassed, because you wouldn't be ashamed if you had a broken leg or diabetes or a heart condition. You'd embrace it and you'd try to get better and you'd work with the doctors. So I think number one is having this positive attitude, you know, almost an aggressive spirit of, I'm not going to let this bring me down. Yeah. So that's number one. Then number two is realizing that the medical profession has very good success rates for dealing with mental illness. Like bipolar disorder is very treatable once they come down with the right diagnosis. I mean, there's medications, there's therapy, there's healthy living, there's the five P's. So it's deciding, I want to get better. I want to live a healthy life for myself, for my spouse, for my family, my friends, my career. I am determined that I'm going to recover and get better. And then I'm going to manage this thing because it's a chronic disease. So it never goes away. Like, I'm going to have bipolar disorder till the day I die. Like right now, it's kind of like a caged lion in the back of my brain. I've got it under control. It's not bothering me, but I have to manage it every day with medications, et cetera. And I think it's, you know, that commitment to living a healthy, happy, purposeful life is critical to recovering and staying well.
Yeah, it sure does. And it's almost like you read my mind going into this this final question. You know, it kind of reminded me of and I'm speaking to this from experience with my father who served, and he was an alcoholic. And so he went to military rehabilitation for that and was clean the rest of his life. So that was in his late 30s, and for the next 35 years, he was, you know, clean. But he always said, you're always an alcoholic, you know, even though you're clean, you're sober, you're going through it one day at a time. It could be 20, 30, 40, 50 years. You're still an alcoholic. That was his perspective. So I wanted to ask you, and it sounds like the answer is yes, but, you know, now that you are a bipolar disorder survivor, do you still feel, as your book says, that you are at a forever war with the condition?
Yes, I am in a forever war. So, you know, I was born with the bipolar genes. They were latent for many years. They gave me a tremendous advantage and contributed to my success for many, many years until they went too high. And then it brought me down, nearly destroyed me. Yeah, to the day I die, I have to, just like you said with your dad, realizing that he was an alcoholic and that he had to keep his guard up, that, you know, you could be sober for 30, 40 years, and then this disease clicks, and then the next thing you know, you take a drink, and then you go back, you know, and you're back in trouble. So I've got to manage this condition in my brain, doing the things that I laid out in my strategy. And it's every day, the structured, balanced life, in partnership with my wife and family, so they know what's going on. My friends, I tell in Cocoa Beach, Florida, you know, I tell all my friends, hey, I live with bipolar disorder. Here are the symptoms of mania and depression. If you see me displaying any of these, please talk to me, talk to my wife, because it could be dangerous. And so I think just acknowledgement and acceptance that the disease is not going to go away. It could come roaring back. But the key to keeping it at bay is yourself. Like, I am the key to my own health.
Yeah.
And, you know, realizing that I'm in a war that's never going to go away is critical. I can't let my guard down, even for a day.
As you were mentioning that, Greg, it seems like you have introduced another element, another virtue to as an attributor to your success of being a survivor of this. And that is your absolute tremendous level and sense of accountability. Actually telling people, hey, I am living with bipolar disorder. You know, I manage it. And here are the symptoms of manic. Here are symptoms of depressive. And letting them know, you know, if you see me in any of these symptoms, you know, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of accountability that you're placing on yourself, and care and compassion that, you know, you're placing, you know, with people, especially in the safe space where you can share that information. So I it's truly commendable inspiring that you share that with us, Greg. I'd like to ask you, how can the listeners connect with you, learn more about your great work, get a copy of your book, and follow you?
Thank you. Thanks for asking that. I would say not only am I a bipolar survivor, but I'm a bipolar thriver. I've really learned to thrive with the disease. Nice. And I consider myself a bipolar warrior, which is, you know, really why and figuring out, you know, how to understand more of where I'm coming from. I'd say number one is the book, and you can get the book, Bipolar General, anywhere that books are sold, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, you know, you name it, you can get it there. The second big source is my website, which is bipolargeneral.com. Lots of information. I've got over 20 published articles, you know, hundreds of interviews, podcasts, you know, things like that, talks that I've given. So the website has got a tremendous amount of information. The other places you can get some real good help, I'll just list a couple. There's an organization called NAMI, which is National Alliance on Mental Illness, 400,000 people across the country, tremendous resource called GRIT. And if you go to grithope.com, and that's GRITHOPE.com, grithope.com, that opens the door to a tremendous amount of material and resources in mental health and resiliency. There's another, if someone is living with bipolar disorder or just any, even if you're healthy, there's a new device. It's called BiAffect, and you can go get it at BiAffect.com, BiAffect.com. It's a Fitbit for the brain. So it's an app that goes on your smartphone, and it tracks sleep and brain patterns. And it's really just like you would wear a Fitbit for your physical health. This is a Fitbit for the brain. Really cool. It's put out by the University of Illinois. So those are just a few resources that I would mention to people to take a look at.
Okay, fantastic. We're definitely going to make sure that we have those links to each of those sites in the episode show notes, so they can click on those resources, learn more about those resources, connect and learn more about you and your journey while listening to this wonderful conversation. Major General Greg F. Martin, sir, I truly, truly appreciate your time on the show, your insights. I appreciate your service to this country. And I want to just thank you again for coming on and sharing some great insights for the listeners and raising that call to action that the stigma needs to be removed. And there's no place for it. And the stigma is actually getting in the way of a lot of people seeking the treatment that they truly, truly need here in society. So, Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show, sir. I hope we stay in touch and hopefully bring you back on the show in the near future.
Hey, thanks, Aubrey. This was fantastic. It was a great honor and a privilege to be on with you. Really enjoyed it. And to all your listeners, thanks for your interest and your support in mental health.
Oh, 100%. Thank you, sir. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening. And hey, look, in our daily struggles and adversities, you know, we may feel like this at times, like we're alone. But the truth of the matter is we're never alone. And hope is always just around the corner. I humbly ask that you please share this show with someone you know, someone you love, who needs motivation, inspiration, and support. We're all roadies on this journey of life, and it sure feels good having you on the road with me. Thanks again for listening. We'll chat again soon. We really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Road to Rediscovery. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at roadsrediscoverypodcast@gmail.com and leave us any questions or comments you may have.